This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
This case doesn't just raise red flags, it kind of lights the whole field on fire. A 9-year-old girl, Melody Buzzard, is missing, and the last adult seen with her, her mother, Ashley. Well, she's walked out of jail with nothing more than an ankle monitor. This is a woman who can't give investigators a single verifiable explanation for where her daughter is. A woman who took that child on a multi-state trip in wigs and swapped plates. A woman who allegedly told a man she knew where the child was, then locked him in her house and threatened him with a box cutter. And somehow, she's out. The public is furious, investigators are stuck, and the system once again is acting like all of this is perfectly normal procedure. Well, according to the rules of procedure, it actually is, because that's how our system works, even though this is not normal. It's outrageous. So Jennifer Coffendaffer is with us, retired FBI special agent, to help us understand how something like this even happens and what investigators are really seeing behind the scenes, while the one person who holds the answers is free to walk away. Let's start with this and call it what it is. Insane. We have a missing 9-year-old. The last adult seen with her can't provide a verifiable explanation for where she is. How is that not enough to hold someone accountable? Hold someone back from being free? How does it not trigger every alarm in the system? Help me understand what is going on here, Jen.
Well, it is shocking that at this point we cannot levy some sort of obstruction charge. I mean, that's what we have here. She's obstructing the investigation, and enough time has gone by that there's just no excuses left available. And when you look at this situation with Tyler, her friend that came over to help her, that gets then locked in her place after she tells him where Melody is, which we know it's a complete lie, because law enforcement would have already investigated and we still have no Melody. So when you look at all of that, right now the excuses are just coming to an end. Law enforcement is, I truly believe, doing what they need to be doing, but the judge to let her out, danger to the community, flight risk, how are those prongs not met? They were.
Was this just a really poor decision by the judge? Were their hands tied? Did they have any other options here? Or was this strategic? Was there something behind the scenes, maybe with investigators, saying, you know, yes, it'd be lovely to keep her locked up. The public has their pitchforks and their flames, and they'd like her to be away. But from an investigative standpoint, is she more valuable if you put the wild animal into her natural environment and see where she goes to eat?
Well, I think when it comes to this judge's decision, he made it very clear that he was only going to go on the facts presented in the case concerning not false imprisonment, basically not letting this individual out of her house. But even if you just go with those facts, which I've never heard of a judge doing, a judge is allowed to use the totality of all the circumstances known regarding an individual when deciding whether they're safe to be out in public. She showed she's a danger to the community, unstable. She used a box cutter to keep this guy in. That's a danger. And then I guess just would not consider at all her extravaganza to Nebraska and back as the flight risk prong.
I don't understand why, going to what she said to Tyler, her friend, saying that, maybe the child is alive somewhere. Couldn't that be viewed as a confession and then hold her at this point?
Well, I think the reason it can't be, and such a great question, but the reason it can't be is because there's nothing to corroborate that. I believe that information Tyler said he gave that to law enforcement right away. They would have followed up on any sort of address, any sort of name, whatever she said they would have followed up on. And again, we have no Melody. So we know it was false. I think she literally, and I'm going to go back to this, it's a beautiful mind, I truly believe. And she doesn't know truth from reality at this point.
I mean, that is certainly what it feels like, that this is something that is completely messed up in her way of thinking, that she's not thinking clearly. It's just kind of things firing left and right. Why is it that it took a a friend that it or a former friend to come in to get these little pieces of information out of her when for more than a month investigators can't get anything. I mean, when we're looking at the approach here with her and how we're handling this to try and get information, I mean, is it being handled incorrectly? Is there a psychological aspect to this that investigators are not equipped with or are not using? I mean, this seems to be like a mental health emergency, and we're treating it from an investigative standpoint or from a law enforcement standpoint just kind of like another law enforcement matter, something where the psychology doesn't really go into play when this is all a sort of a mental health crisis that's in action, but we don't seem to have the mental health tools to deal with it.
Well, there's two approaches, right? One is what I think law enforcement was sort of doing is not charging anything because, first of all, I think the obstruction charge, they're worried, won't hold water from this standpoint. As a mother, as a guardian, when you have full custody of your child, you're allowed to take them wherever you want. You're allowed to drop them off with a friend. There is nothing illegal about that. Now, there are issues in concerning truancy. But back in October 1st of this year, the truancy laws in California became non-felonious. So in other words, you can keep your kids out of school and it's not a felony violation anymore. So as things get more and more liberal thinking from a law enforcement standpoint in California, that I think also helped cause law enforcement not to have the tools they needed to charge her.
Do you think this happens all the time and this is just a case that we're hearing about, that there are more cases just like this that never make the news?
I think there are many cases like this from the standpoint of people being quote unquote homeschooled, people being abused. And I'm not saying, by the way, that Ashley abused Melody. Look, I think Ashley treated Melody like a possession. She wanted to keep her away from family. She wanted to keep her away from friends. She wanted to keep her in control of her. So I'm not saying she was abused other than what we know to be facts if we're to believe the mother, and that is no food in the house, no edible food, squalor, all of that could be considered neglect. It happens all the time, I could tell you. Walking into these homes, you just wouldn't believe it.
Yeah.
If we don't have Melody, and nobody other than Ashley seems to have any clue as to where she is right now, and she's a free woman for the most part with an ankle monitor, if not now, when? What would it take to arrest her? Is there a certain time threshold we're waiting for here where after X amount of days you don't produce your kid, now we'll arrest you? I mean, what lever are we waiting for here to be pulled? Because if the Melody never shows up, is what happens here, and she's wherever, dead somewhere in a woods that no one will ever find her in, does Ashley just stay free forever? I mean, why? What are we waiting for? What are we waiting for to try and get to that point other than just, well, she's been gone a really long time now, she must be dead?
Well, I think certainly what the Bureau's doing, because the Bureau is handling all that cross the state's investigation. We know she was last seen on the eastern side of the Colorado-Utah border. So now we have a stretch of about 800 miles where Melody disappeared, or Ashley disappeared Melody. And that is what they're really focusing on. But it takes so much time to go through all of that information from the car detail, whatever phone digital evidence there might be, and then interviewing witnesses that might have seen her. All of that takes so much time and so many man hours, and that's what they're doing. Analysts are pouring over all this information, I can tell you. And as they finally figure out the last point she's seen before Ashley shows up without Melody, that's when they're going to tighten that timeline, and I think they get to more answers.
But how is this not a crime already? Where, yeah. if she's not telling anybody where the kid is, and she doesn't have the kid, and she left the house, and the kid, now we don't know where the kid is. She just saying, she's like, what is she telling authorities that they're able to walk away and go, okay, that checks out?
Well, first of all, we all have a Fifth Amendment right. not to cooperate with an investigation. We all have that right. And it happens all the time. And I'll bring you back to Gabby Petito. When the laundries were questioned, I mean, Gabby Petito dead, her van in the front yard. They're doing search warrants. Those parents have never talked other than in civil litigation when they had to talk. So it happens all the time. But I know what your point is, Tony. You're saying, oh, my God, this is about the welfare of a child. This is exigent. This isn't just, you know, an event. This is brutally exigent. The problem is that Fifth Amendment right prevails unless they want to charge you with obstruction and risk them not having a strong enough case to convict.
How would this not be strong enough? There's a missing human being. Yeah. And I get the Gabby Petito thing, and that's a whole other conversation. Gabby was an adult. Those were not her parents. And they were not on the trip. Now, Brian went off and did his own damn thing. So there's a bit of a difference there, and I get the Fifth Amendment right there. This is someone who is dependent on Ashley for her well-being. Is there no difference in the law between the Gabby Petito scenario and this scenario when you have a minor dependent that is now missing, that was in your care and is now gone missing? I don't understand how this is how our system works, where they can just disappear and you can be like, whoops.
Yeah, sorry.
like, well, I went on a road trip, must have left her at the come and go somewhere. You know, it's like, what? Like, this is just... I don't understand how there's no actionable things that can be pulled by law enforcement to compel her to speak, that we can just be like, well, you're good. Just because you don't have her, that's okay. This is just, it's asinine.
It seems untenable that you can just drop your child somewhere and just go, like Tony said, like, whatever. Next one. I've got two more, so, you know, whatever. Where is this loophole that can be closed at this point?
It's called the Fifth Amendment. And it's I'll give you another example. If you don't like the Gabby Petito example,
yeah,
this one. How about the Harmony Montgomery, Adam Montgomery? She was missing for over 2 years. Law enforcement approached him, talked to him, told him he had to talk. And he said, up yours. I'm not talking. I'm not saying where she's at. And but for the, you know, wife coming forward at the time and telling about the horrendous details, nothing would have been done. In the case that I like to talk about, because this case exactly mimics this case, is the Hoggle case, H-O-G-G-L-E, out of Maryland. That case is so similar. Again, a mother, in that case, two children, disappears her children back in 2014. She's arrested 3 years later, but they don't have enough to hold her because she's got psychiatric problems. Finally, while she's institutionalized in one of these group therapy sessions, she tells the group that she strangled the kids and that she put them in the trash. So finally, in 2025, 11 years later, she was finally charged. She's just been charged, but guess again. But guess what? They're still holding hearings to see if she's competent to stand trial. I think this is a Hoggle part two called Buzzard.
But again, with the psychiatric slant to it, how can you believe what she has to say?
Well, they believe it. And I believe it's probably because there was enough detail that they had some corroboration to back that all up. Again, those kids have been missing for 11 years. And persona non grata can be proven in a court of law. A lot of murder cases are tried without a body. And that's what they're doing in this case.
So all you have to do if you want to make your kids go away is just basically make them disappear somewhere and say you know nothing about it.
It's
and true. You're good. And never speak of it again.
Unless the Bureau, and I have not given up on the Bureau at all, unless the Bureau can get that timeline tightened up, show where she stayed an extended period of time in a certain area, and then thoroughly search that particular area, which is still a needle in a haystack, I think
yes.
It's very difficult without a body or without a witness.
I just don't understand this. I mean, I do and I don't. Because, like, okay, here's a scenario. Riddle me this one. You get a beater. You get one of those old cars. You get one that doesn't have GPS and all that. You know, it's literally winding windows and a, no, not even a car radio. It's like, we're just talking, like it's a Geo Metro. Like,
and it smells musty.
And it smells musty. And it smells of fish for some reason. You're not quite sure why, but it smells of fish. And I don't know why I think, but it just smells of fish. And you don't take your cell phone. And you are like in the middle of nowhere, someplace where there's not going to, like, you get out of your metro area, then you just go on a path of no cameras or as few cameras as possible. You're on just back roads and you go and you go and you go. And then you let the kids out, kill them, do whatever. You don't tell anybody you did this, but you do it. And it's just, it's in the middle of bumblefuck nowhere. And then there they are. They're gone. You drive back. There's no real evidence. I'm just going to tell where you went or where you came because you didn't bring your cell phone. And there's not in the area to which you went. There's just nothingness. And there's certainly vast areas of our country of nothingness. And you come back and you just like, I don't know. Am I right? I don't have to tell you where they're fine.
So
and if you never say a word of it again and nobody's ever able to find the bodies, you're free.
So first of all, you basically described the exact area that Ashley was in.
Yeah.
I mean, she did not, she veered off the highway in Utah and went down a rural route road that is very off the beaten track. I post a lot of pictures. I mean, it's the desert. Yeah. And so when you're in places like that, it's so easy, even if you have your phone on, that it's not going to work. And all she had to do, quite frankly, was turn off her phone. I mean, that's what Koberger did, right?
Yeah.
We don't know what he did in a long stretches of time, exactly where he was at.
But and that shows guilt too, though.
Oh, well, it shows guilt, but guilty of what? Guilty of, so what are we going to charge? Are we going to charge leaving her with somebody? We don't have proof of that. She can't be charged with kidnapping. She is the guardian of that child. We can't charge her with a murder. We have no evidence of murder.
So there's no difference here between a dependent like Melody is, and if it were her boyfriend or Ashley's boy, and I'm just throwing a hypothetical out there, another human being, another adult that's not a dependent, that has their own agency, that can make their own choices. If you can simply disappear them and not answer any questions about where they went, even if they're a dependent, you're scot-free.
Well, you can't be forced to answer to law enforcement. I've been harping on this one avenue that can be used, and that is the dependency court. And it exists particularly in California. And they can a person like Ashley can receive a summons from a dependency court judge and be summoned and made to come into court. And if she cannot provide answers as to where Melody is and what happened to the satisfaction of that judge, she can be held in contempt and thrown in jail. And I think that's what should happen, because possibly she could be medicated. She could go to a counseling session. How about a Perkins Act? I would love something like that, where they put an undercover in the cell with her, buddy up with her, and maybe get us and law enforcement community some answers. There are avenues. Nobody's taking them.
Why?
One of our commenters here, Jennifer, says, what about charging her with neglect to put the pressure on her?
And that's happened before in that Hoggle case. I looked back at that to see the steps they took. And they charged neglect, child endangerment they charged.
Sure.
I thought was something that could possibly be used here, because if you drive 1,500 miles with a child and then return, so another at least 3,000 total miles on no sleep, just stopping for gas, was she fed, all those things, that could be a child endangerment, I think. I think that they are reluctant to charge anything right now because they don't want it not to stick. Listen, we just saw what happened with a guy that was held at box cutter, and wasn't allowed to leave. And she was out in a couple days. So, I mean, that's the system.
Oh, it's disheartening.
It's just, It's maddening. I mean, how is this even possible? I do not understand this, that this can go on for this period of time. We're only a couple months in, and you gave examples of cases where it's taken literally years, more than a decade in some, for anything to for anyone to be held accountable. This is just one we're hearing about. This is one that we have publicity on. This is one that the authorities are actively investigating. Is there a difference in this case because the father is dead and the father is not in the picture? Or, I mean, what would the scenario be if the father was alive? And is there a difference if the father was had any sort of custodial rights with that child and then one parent disappeared the child versus if they did not have any custodial rights? Would there be any difference in weight here on finding this kid or holding the parent accountable that disappeared the child?
I love this question because this is what the FBI does very well, is we handle custodial kidnapping cases. And that's where you have an individual like this go off the rails, and then you have the other normal parent that says, listen, I have custody too. They've stolen, you know, my child. They go through court and show, and then they put out, a unlawful flight to avoid prosecution is what we call it, a UFAP warrant. And the Bureau gets to finding these parental kidnappers that are unstable. And yeah, it's so much different in terms of legally what we can do, especially once you find them. But in this case, she's the sole guardian, and that's what makes this much more complicated, kind of like Adam Montgomery with Harmony Montgomery.
So simply because she's the sole guardian and the other person's dead, because there's no one else contesting this, there's nobody else out there raising in a parental form because of legally being a parental figure, it's pretty much the system is designed. Is it because the system is designed? The system is not designed to assume or be prepared for a parent working against the best interest of their child. I mean, it seems like this was something, the way that it's functioning, no one saw this coming, and no one's ever made any fixes to it since. Clearly, we've run down this road many a times, but nothing ever seems to change in terms of what needs to be done here when somebody's going to pull the levers and basically hack the system and use it to their advantage the way that she is right now.
Right. At the core, that's exactly right. At the core of all of this is why the law is in place. And it's in place to keep the family together. It's in place to make sure that the guardians have the power they need to control what happens with their children. You know, nobody as a general rule wants the government telling them where they can educate their child, where they can take their child, who can watch their child. That is not something the general public wants to see. And so the laws protect those people, but unfortunately, it doesn't regard the individuals who are not acting in the best
interest. But there has to be a safeguard that if you're not doing X, Y, and Z, they step in and do something. And X, Y, and Z has not been fulfilled in this case.
Well, X, Y, and Z, what is X, Y, and Z? The fact that she's not telling anyone what happened to Melody. Again, we circle back to the Fifth Amendment, and unless they get her in dependency court, to me, that's the only answer here. Or there's only one more answer that I can think of. And that is if somebody, the mother of Ashley or the paternal grandparents, step in, go to the court and say, we want to petition for custody. Mm. If they petition for custody, I see that at least as some leverage, that at least if she's found, you know, something could be done. I would love to see such a petition take place. And I think it would help possibly get some answers.
Because right now she's in the custody of no one. I mean, on paper, she's in the custody of Ashley, but she's not there. But the law doesn't seem to recognize that part.
Right. The law doesn't recognize that part. And let's face it, to me, there has been nobody that's come forward. Nobody that said, by the way, this woman named Ashley dropped off a 9-year-old with me.
Yeah.
Or a neighbor saying, there's this 9-year-old that just showed up at this house. The leads that were given by Tyler, that were given to him by Ashley obviously didn't pan out, or we wouldn't even be here today because Melody would have been found by law enforcement. I just feel like I'm going to call it 90-10. 10% chance that she's still alive.
I agree.
And I don't think she was sex trafficked. I know that that is the big dialogue running, and I could be completely wrong. I just do not see that as a possibility, a very probable possibility.
Why is your gut telling you that?
It's really not my gut. I always said as an investigator, I never used my gut. I used facts before me. I mean, I know a lot of investigators do, and a lot of people say, oh, my gut tells me. My gut's never told me anything. What tells me are the facts I see before me. I see a woman completely wanting control of her child. I see a woman whose proximal event, and anytime you have a major instance happen, there's always one huge proximal event. I think that was the school board saying, where the hell is she? And we need answers. I think that was the proximal event. She thought they were going to come and take her child away, especially in her paranoid state. She takes off with her. The changing of the license plates, we've talked about it, the wigs, all that she did, I think, shows that she wanted to do everything to stay and maintain control of her. Remember, she was the one ripping up missing posters. Yeah. She doesn't want anybody's help because she knows exactly where she is. She's in control of that child, whether she's dead or alive. She knows where she is.
This would just be pure speculation at this point, but do you think that she left her daughter alive when she drove away? Or do you like, I mean, if you're talking a delusional state here and someone who's not playing with a full deck and they really truly care about their child in a control sort of way. And they, you know, want them alive, you would think, you would maybe think that that person would go hide them, you know, quote unquote, someplace. Or I'm going to go here. We're going to go. I'm going to put you in this whatever, abandoned this or that. It's to stay here until I come get you again. So no one can, something like that. Or do you think it was the ultimate control of, oh, I know where she is and she's not going anywhere because I made sure of that?
I think the number one scenario is the one you just came up with. And I really do. For anybody who has dealt with people like this, and if you haven't, please go rent A Beautiful Mind. That is a true story. Crow's in it. He does a great job acting in it. And it's a true story of the, you know, the imagination used and what becomes their reality. Mm-hmm. Where they think they're at, who they think is chasing them, all of that. It's just made up in their head. I could absolutely, and that's my number one scenario, is she really did do something like that. Remember, this is a critical piece that people may not know about or recall. I think it was around October 28th, right in that time frame, she tried to rent a car again. She was under surveillance. She tried to rent a car again. She couldn't get the car rented. And when I say under surveillance, by media, not by law enforcement in this particular state situation, and they wouldn't rent her a car. Where was she going in that car? She wasn't running away. She was running back to where Melody was. That will always be my belief with why she tried to get in.
Then why don't we try and get her to get in a car and go again? I mean, if she's delusional, if she's not in her right mind, she probably doesn't understand all the levers of the law that are being pulled around her right now. Just surprise, you just want a car, you know? Bob Barker shows up, or the ghost of him shows up, and ta-da, or just something, and just something that, guess what, we're going to give you a car, and you can go anywhere you want, and of course you tail it, but if you're dealing with someone without a full deck, but you take away the confines of you're going to have to pay for this, because if finances is a thing, that's going to stop her. Number two, if she thinks that, she already knows they're going to reject her getting a car, let's give her a fucking car and say, have fun. Let's see where it takes you.
And the Bureau has case funds for this, and they could do that, something like that, under some sort of ruse, something that comes in the mail. Ha, you're the lucky winner of a Honda Accord or whatever it might
be.
But this is the problem. First of all, and I've always said this, if they could arrest her, if they could get her off the streets, I think they would, if they thought legally it would hold. But I think they know that she would just bond out and they'd be back to square one. So I think that's why they haven't come in hot yet. Secondarily, I think they really did hope that she would have been able to get out. And I'm sure if they could have known that she went to this rental car agency or she was going to Uber over there, they would have done that. They would have said, listen, let her have the car, Avis. Let her take off. We'll be held responsible. Here's the, you know, money necessary, because the Bureau has case books and things like that.
Then have someone call her home and say, this is Avis. You know what? Turns out you can get that car. And we're going to deliver it to you right now. It's kind of, and a lifetime supply of wigs, you know, and all the Sonic gift cards you need along the way to feed yourself. I mean, seriously, I mean, it's not an insane idea. If we're going to play crazy over here, we're like the person can basically go free forever. Why not play crazy with the crazy person if that may lead us to where this kid actually is, and hope to God she's found enough food to scrounge around with and continue living. Or we're going to find some kid dead in an abandoned shack somewhere. But either way, we'll get our answer. Other than that, this idea that we're just going to let her exist, this is insane. I mean, this, who's crazy here? Who's crazier, her or the rest of the world, if this is how we're letting it play out?
Well, I know it seems like we're over a month now, and it's so long for her to still be alive. But law enforcement, it just takes such a long time. I'm telling you, 800 miles, a stretch of 800 miles of road. This is a
new— I know, and I don't expect random people to figure it out. Give her the car.
Well, I liked that idea, and I was hoping that that was something that sort of law enforcement might be working on. I think we talked about it briefly. I indicated that as a possibility. Like I said, if they could lock her up and keep her in, they would have done that. That's the number one. If they can't, then maybe they were hoping for this to finesse its way to her, to what happened. And remember, she could have been— she could have made it all the way back in and around Lompoc, California. Yeah. We don't know how far they got with her. I've always thought it was interesting that they had already done a search warrant on the 15th, I believe, of October, went back and did that second of, you know, the vehicle, but they were able to go back to that house again. That's very interesting to me, because you have to reestablish probable cause, and not only probable cause that there could be indicia of a crime, but that it's there right now. Those are the parameters of probable cause for that. So there was something that gave them the probable cause to relook that happened in between that time frame. And I would love to read that affidavit. Law enforcement has so much more we're not seeing. They're showing us what they need to show us to get our help.
And if we don't have any arrests yet, and what is that telling you about the digital footprint that she has, or lack thereof? I mean, usually in so many cases, that's what sinks so many people. It's their Google histories. It's this, it's that. But if I mean, a lot of times behavior like this isn't Googling, it's acting. And if she just decides one day, I'm going to go out and get this car and I got to go hide my kid, there may not have been a lot of search or premeditation to do any of those sort of things. Is that telling you something, that there is no arrest too, because there isn't anything in any sort of digital footprint that would point to suspicious activity involving disappearing or murdering a child?
Absolutely. And I still can't believe there's nothing to just point out the obstruction piece of it.
Yeah.
Nothing in her digital footprint to show. I mean, it's in her physical footprints all over the place. Yeah. Right? She's obstructing. But why can't they get over that probable cause, really reasonable doubt pump? Because that's what a prosecutor is going to want, to take her in. And like I said, I think behind bars, things could drastically change and turn for the better for understanding what happened.
But instead, they put a bracelet on her ankle that she could cut off, and she's gone. She disappears into the night like an X-File.
Let me ask you this. If Melody shows up, let's say Melody is with somebody in some other state or wherever, and then Ashley gets her back, comes back, and everything's just hunky-dory and normal, has a crime been committed?
I think there is no chance she would retain custody of her. I think the state would get custody based on everything we saw before us, which I think you're going to say. But Jen... And if we, you know, not a crime, but basically that she is not that she's neglectful of her duties as a mother. I think CPS would come in and get an order to have her removed temporarily while it's all sorted out in the court, whether she should maintain custody.
But what if it was a private thing between her and a friend and nobody needs to tell anybody where the kid is, because that's what the law is. And the kid was there. And I mean, you could probably get her on the custody or the welfare thing if she's not being educated. But let's say she's getting education. If everything is just going, we're not telling anybody what we're doing, but this is what we're doing. And the kid is actually in good care, gets her back. Kid's in good health. Has a crime been committed other than she's just not telling anybody what's going on in her world?
I think that would be for a court to sort out, because if she left her in good care with somebody, if she's getting homeschooled, now obviously we know she's not in school anywhere.
Sure. I mean,
it's an act of God to get your kid in school.
Yeah.
So we know she's not in school anywhere, but she could be homeschooled. And if somebody could prove that, and if she was well fed and being well taken care of, I agree with you, Tony. And, you know, she's returned. What's the crime? There's no crime there. But the problem is, I don't think that's what we're going to find.
Yeah. And maybe it should be a crime if you can't tell anybody where your kid is, especially authorities, when everyone's looking. Maybe that should be a crime in itself. But unfortunately, it's not. We're all learning. Let's move over to another case, another missing person that, or not missing person, but another case where they're no longer with us, and we don't know the answers to what's going on. And it involves a celebrity. There's a moment in every investigation where the silence gets louder than the facts. And right now, in the death of 14-year-old, 13 when she died, Celeste Rivas Hernandez, is silence from the Los Angeles Police Department. It's kind of deafening. They've now doubled down on their earlier statements, saying it stands on its own. That statement, for anyone who hasn't been tracking every beat of this case, boils down to something stark. The medical examiner still hasn't determined Celeste's cause or manner of death. And without that, the LAPD says the only confirmed criminal act this time is basically the concealment of a body. That's it. A girl found inside the front trunk, the frunk of a Tesla, registered to David. Severely decomposed. Stuffed in a bag, allegedly. And officially, the only thing they can point to today is that somebody hid her body. No homicide charge, no manslaughter, no negligence, not yet. And that gap between what the public sees and what the victim deserves and what the system is currently willing to call a crime is enormous. It's painful. And it raises questions about absolute demand for answers. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, is with us to break this one down. You've been tracking this case on your own for a while, pretty much since it started making headlines here. Let's start with that LAPD statement. They doubled down on that September release, basically saying cause and manner still undetermined, and the only provable act is concealment of a body. What does that kind of language tell you as an investigator?
Well, this is what this is saying. Shut up. Leave us alone. We'll get back to you when we have something.
Okay? Yeah.
That's what that statement says in a very nice way. I mean, look, they have to have a forensic anthropologist break down the 70 pounds of matter that they have. And that's all they have. They have to have a forensic entomologist look at what bugs are eating her up when they found her, to figure out possibly when she actually died and everything they can figure out from those bugs. That toxicology, I guarantee they've known her tox for probably weeks. They just haven't released it. That's critical as well. You put that all together, and I'm going to give you another analogous case. Suzanne Morphew. Morphew, tranquilizer gun, purportedly killed, charged, malfeasance by the prosecutor. Charges dismissed, and then they found the body. When they found that body, they did all of this I'm just telling you about, toxicology, which led to that tranquilizer. They found, they were able to do the bug guy and the anthropologist, and they were able to make a case. Guess how long that took from found in the grave, even with everything they had before that, which they had dozens and dozens of pages of probable cause, and in one of the longest probable cause affidavits I've ever seen. Guess how long it took. I can't wait to hear your guesses. From when they found her body to when they indicted her husband again.
That was quite a bit. That was several. That was many months, wasn't it? I mean, was it more than a year?
21 months.
21 months from identifying the BAM in her bones, basically, which was the sedative that was in the tranquilizer dart that they claim he had on him. Is that because it took that long to get those sort of results out of wow. The anthropological technology?
Yep. It took the anthropologist that long. It takes the toxicologist that long, that sort of, you know, uniqueness. And then, like I said, these bug doctors tell a lot, you know, what's eating your flesh.
It's disgusting, mm-hmm. but it's a very accurate science.
It's accurate. It takes forever. It takes a long time, that forensic anthropology, unless it's something obvious like a gunshot wound. That's why Brian Laundry, they came back in, you know, no time because his mm-hmm. skull was fractured. But other than that, if it's nothing like that, if it's something more systemic, it's going to be much tougher to tell.
So what is it going to tell us? If we don't know what it's going to tell, but what can it tell us? What are the possibilities that are going to come back from the forensic anthropologist once they have their results?
Well, a couple of things. One of the top things that everybody's been discussing from minute one is whether she was dissected, mm-hmm. dismembered, every one of term it, whether she was dismembered. They are going to look, and the only way to dismember somebody typically is with a tool. So they're going to be looking for those tool marks to dismember. Are they there? Are they not? In other words, if she just fell apart from, you know, decay, that would be far different from being dismembered. So they're going to be.
That's a felony, right? I mean, you can't dismember a body in that state, can you, without it becoming a felony?
Of course. Yeah. And exactly to your point. So now they're going to have something to really work with, even though, and I know we've talked about this, it was reported early on by the local station before they ever knew her name was Celeste Rivas.
Yeah.
The day this was reported was the first day I reported on it, not even knowing it was Celeste Rivas, not even knowing who David was.
Yeah.
Just it was a body because they were begging the public for help. Back in the day one, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things they released, multiple things, right? 70 pounds, that tattoo that was on the finger, and dismembered body. Mm-hmm. And of course, you all featured my very scientific showing of how you can't fit a 5'1.5",
yes,
110-pound human into a frunk.
Mm-hmm.
I stick by that. Unless they, you know, broke her down or dismembered her. And we have the pictures of the bag in the frunk in that junkyard. So we have it.
Yeah, you were breaking that down on your show the other day, Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer, which you can get wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. Tell me about that. Tell me about those pictures that you were looking at and breaking down.
Well, yeah, when you look at this picture, first of all, I do want to say this is the latest model Tesla, and they did increase the frunk space by about 2 cubic feet to accommodate, quite frankly, golf clubs.
Or and, body.
Yeah, or body. No, you could still only get golf clubs in there.
Okay.
Who's the size of a golf club unless you're like 5?
Yeah.
Our dimensions just don't work. So like yeah. I said, unless they literally.
Or a child.
Yeah.
If you're on our other story, if you're the other case, our buzzard issue.
Yeah. I mean, you're just not going to be able to fit a full
gun
there. But nevertheless, I just wanted to say that for anybody going, oh, but Jennifer, I know he had the latest model. And so, yeah, I've looked that up and you can look it up.
Okay.
I really want to find one of those and jump into that just to show all the naysayers. You can get clubs.
You had a Tesla dealership doing that.
Well, I wanted to do it. I've just been too dang busy. But the minute I get a chance, I'm going to. Believe me, you'll see part two.
You're
going to
be on a list quick.
It was funny. I was with my closest friends of 20 years and over the weekend in a celebration. And anyway, I told them about this. And they're all very normal people. They're not into true crime. They're just rich people, right? They're like, you had Thad do what? Of course, they feel terrible for my poor husband because they're like, how did you convince him to do that? And I said, he's so sweet. You know, I begged him. And because I wanted to make the point. And literally, we as investigators, as FBI agents, number one thing you use if you're successful is common sense.
Yeah.
And you say, that just isn't going to work, but let's make sure that I'm not. And how can a 5'3" brawny David, who, as far as I know, doesn't work out. He's never talked about working out, but I've seen him many times, extremely under the influence and everything else. He doesn't seem like the healthiest guy, let's just say. How is he going to pick up somebody his approximate size when somebody who's 5'10", 180 can't do that to me?
Sure.
Because I'm slippery and everything else, dead weight. But all that aside, the whole point is when you break down the pictures of her in that trunk, or in that frunk, if you look at that bag, it seems to have a lot of excess room in it. The one that she's in, the actual frunk bag of Celeste Rivas, not the one I did, the one of her.
That's right.
And remember, they said the remains were only 70 pounds. So basically half of her weight. Why? So much decomposition. And remember, as far as we know, at least the last picture seen by the PI that went into the place, Her last photo was taken on January 2nd. Just think of the composition that would take place during all that time, found in September.
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm sure conditions have a lot to do with it. I would imagine a trunk, it's sealed off fairly. I don't know how sealed off. I would imagine it's fairly sealed off from a lot of things getting into it, but you know, nature will do its course of whatever. And then for a body to break down to 70 pounds from whatever she was, I'm assuming probably close. Do we know what she originally was? Close to 100, somewhere around there, I'm going to guess. I mean, just looking at her pictures, that'd be my guesstimate. What's that?
110 to 115. I'm going to say approximate size.
So we're talking losing roughly 30, 40 pounds of body weight due to decomposition. How long would that take? I mean, how long do you think that would take in an environment like that? Essentially, it would be a small oven in the California heat. Out there, which, you know, that certainly does a lot for breaking down tissue and basically cooking someone for months. I'm wondering how long would that take, would you think?
Well, a couple of factors there, right? Again, we talked about the bugs and we talked about the heat and the plastic.
Yeah.
Since in law enforcement, when we go in and we take anything that's biodegradable, we do not put it in plastic because it increases the rate of it degrading.
Yeah.
We use paper for things even like blood, even like hair. It can only go in paper. So it's because we as investigators know that rapidly accelerates decomposition. I obviously am not a forensic anthropologist, but I can tell you that it would break down that body so quickly in that environment, so much more quickly compared to, say, a dry situation. And I'll give you another good analogy. Do you remember Gene Hackman and his wife?
No.
Yeah.
Right? They were found in the house, and they had been there for weeks and weeks and weeks, but it was dry, and they were basically mummified. So they were really decomposed. They were mummified in almost a similar state as to when they died, right? And so that's the juxtaposition between moisture, heat, being confined, bugs taking over that Celeste would put in.
And I'm thinking that's what a lot of people, as they try to run this through their mind of, well, why couldn't they tell if she was in the trunk for that long? I think a lot of people go to mummified and they think, well, it's going to be stiff. It's going to be dried up. No, I mean, I'm not trying to be gross here, but if she's in this bag, she was pretty much a pile of goo and bones, I would imagine, at that point. I mean, if you've ever, and I'm thinking in terms of cooking, I mean, these are the only times I've ever dealt with bones as like a turkey or something, you know, or something where if you... Here's a good example. Your big old Tupperware, okay? You put it in, you got extra turkey. Maybe it's a chicken or something. And you put it in your fridge. It ends up in the back of the fridge, maybe your basement fridge or your garage fridge or whatever. Oh my God, the turkey is still there from Thanksgiving and it's Easter. And you're like, oh, I need that container. We need to like, you know, really clean that thing out strategically. And you go in there and it was at one time a whole turkey or pieces of it that were certain, you know, together, and then you go to lift it out and it smells and but you lift one piece up and just the bones come off. Everything just comes apart because that's what it is. It's broken down. It's become this gelatinous mess. You're not going to tell how that turkey died anymore. You're not even going to tell what it was cooked in anymore unless you go to the breakdown, the chemical breakdown, the anthropologic breakdown, which could tell you some of those things. But even then, it can't tell you everything because the breakdown is so, so dramatic. That essentially is what we're talking about here of the body of Celeste Rivas Hernandez. And maybe also why early on, I'm going to say, maybe is that why you think some of the reports were saying that she was dismembered? Do you think that might have been a misunderstanding, maybe an early investigator misspeaking because the body parts were coming apart and they're like, oh, she was dismembered and this has kind of leaked out and it was more so, no, she's been basically cooked.
Okay, any investigator, and the only investigator out there that would have looked at this would have been somebody in that homicide unit.
Yeah.
They're going to know the difference, I believe, between a decomposed body that has fallen apart, so to speak, as opposed to a dismembered body.
Yeah.
And you're going to know, you're going to see tool markings on the body. That's going to make it very clear that this was somebody dismembered versus somebody that just fell apart. So I believe that they would know. I really do. Because you're cutting bones and everything, and the bones would still be there. At least some of them. There were 70 pounds.
But I'm saying, what if you're not cutting, if they're just there? I mean, again, like, let's do a turkey challenge. Let's both buy a turkey and let's put it in a hot box until Easter. And then I'll carve it and you don't carve yours. And then, or then you take it out and say, can you tell which one was carved or not? Or which one just... they just slowly kind of decomposed and deteriorated. If you don't hit the bone, I don't know that you would necessarily know that. I mean, I'm sure if you're a person that studies it, you would. I'm just wondering, somebody on the back end of this, somebody who's working in conjunction with this, and they're like, well, this body part's over here now, and this is over there. If they're thinking, oh, well, dismembered, but really it's just because they got cooked.
You know what? I will take you on with that.
Oh, boy.
Let's cook some turkeys in our trunks, Jen.
I will say that it can be even lesser time and more dramatic situation. I agree with the Tupperware. But we need to take a Cornish hen. You take a Cornish hen, a little bitty Cornish hen, and you don't do anything to yours.
Okay.
And put it in and put it in a very, very hot place that you can't smell. Because it's going to get smelly within about 3 days. The hottest place you can. And I know exactly where I'm putting mine.
You're going to do this, aren't you? You're really going to do it. She's going to do it. She got in a frunk.
I'm going to cut mine.
Okay.
And you're not going to cut yours.
Okay.
And then we're going to look in 3 weeks at our Cornish hens. And I guarantee I'm going to be any naked eye, anybody is going to see those cut marks on those bones.
Well, we'll check in 3 weeks. You will. Let's see Easter. We got to keep this thing there. Cause if we're assuming that her body was in that trunk or frunk for damn near half a year. So maybe 4th of July.
We'll
get our Cornish hens out.
We'll do the 4th of July. I think this will be interesting.
Where are you putting it? We gotta have similar heat on this. We're going into winter.
Yeah, this is going to be hard.
We're going into winter. Listen, it's not going to be perfect, but both of our Cornish hens are going to be severe. Oh, we need to weigh them before they go in. Are going to be severely decomposed. And to our point that we would be trying to make is, would an investigator know whether that was decomposition or whether that was purposeful
chopping? All right. You get your Rubbermaid, I'll get mine. You get your Cornish hen and I'll get mine. And we'll find places to put them. Okay. Although, wouldn't the gases make the top of the Rubbermaid explode at some point?
It's possible. No,
we'll be fine. No. It's a Cornish hen.
We'll burp and seal it.
Listen, I'm not going to touch mine again until the 4th of July.
All right. I can't wait. I'm going to take it out right with the appetizers. Hey, everybody. Cornish hen. We talked about this right before Thanksgiving of last year. It's all ready to go.
Going to need a hazmat suit.
To it. Can't let them go. I mean, mine's going outside in this little place I have. It'll be perfect.
Yeah. You're in Florida, though, aren't you?
That Cornish hen will likely be in Florida.
Okay. There's mine's in Northwest Arkansas, but... all right, we'll see if as long as the crocodile doesn't get it.
Oh, or is it alligator? Now I'm confused.
Alligators.
Yeah. Alligators, sorry about that.
There are some crocs here, believe it or not, in the bayous. There are some in the Everglades. In the Everglades, yeah, there are. That's what those pythons are eating that right now.
Oh, yeah.
Pythons are out.
A python mixed in this, too. That would be it. Send me a python, Jen. Send me a python, and I'll just put a python out, and you put a python out. It's silly as it is, obviously, it's horrible what we're looking at here. At the end of the day, do you think we're ever going to see anyone charged with a crime here, or is this going to be something where there's a concealment of a body? I don't know. I mean, I'm wondering, was a crime committed here other than concealment of a body, or was this a combination of really bad choices? Someone died unexpectedly, and nobody wanted to be accountable for having the death of a runaway underage child with them. And they thought, well, let's hide it. The only thing I'm wondering about is, was there strategy evolved of putting this thing in the back of a trunk, hoping for this exact process to take place, basically the cooking of the body, so that it was unrecognizable, and any sort of forensic details that would have existed in terms of abuse or anything, if that was there, would have all basically melted away.
Well, and I want to be clear on just one thing. All we know is the January 2nd date, again, according to what would have been left in the mansion. So there could have been pictures of her, and she could have been alive after that.
Sure.
I'm just saying that's the only fact we have to go on. Mm-hmm. Go on the fact that we know. Secondarily, I guarantee you there will be charges. There will be charges, and I think there'll be charges against more than one person. I think there will be multiple people involved as far as what will those charges be. Minimally, the concealment of a body, desecration of a body, possibly. And then murder, possibly, depending on what that forensic anthropologist says.
Yeah. Is there any, just because David's name is linked to the vehicle, does that mean there'd be a charge against him for just owning the vehicle? If he had no physical involvement or awareness of any of this, or does it all come down to any sort of awareness that he would have had of any of this going on?
What it's going to come down to is, would he be able, if he weren't the main person doing this, would he be able to be charged with conspiracy? And Tony, to be charged with conspiracy, you need two overt acts. So what were those overt acts? Were they letting him have the car? That's an overt act. Were they showing anything? Overt acts can be the smallest of things. Driving somebody. So we know that somebody drove that car and parked it. How did they get to that car? You know, it's his car. So I see very possibly a conspiracy type situation following him, because all you need are two of the, you can have a text message. That's an overhead telephone call. So there's not much they have to prove conspiracy. So basically, if he knew about it and conspired in any way to make that body disappear, or go into that trunk, he's going to be in trouble.
But if he's clueless?
He's not clueless.
I'm just saying if. We don't know, because we don't know the answer to that. I mean, these people have big circles and posses around them of people that all have, you know, their own selfish needs and wants and desires of what they're doing. And they're, you know, either they're cozying up to celebrity for that, or they're an employee and that's part of what they do. And they just kind of go from person to person. So I don't think we do know that for sure. I think there's a possibility that we don't know the answer, that he thought, well, she went off back home or did whatever, and that groupie's gone now or whatever. And there's no knowledge. I think there's a real possibility there that then somebody else in the crew got her hands on her, but we don't know.
Oh gosh, where's my $120,000 Tesla? Dang, I guess I just lost it.
All right,
moving on.
I know.
Who does that?
No one does. He knew that Tesla was gone. It is a common sense Occam's razor. That's this case. Beeline, you know, light on him being involved in some way, in my opinion.
You got a good point. I mean, he was a celebrity. He is a celebrity. He has some fame. He has some money. He doesn't have that kind of money where you're missing a Tesla, where you wouldn't be aware that your $100-some-thousand-dollar car is being used. But again, let me go the other way too. Oh, let me let my best friend or good friend or manager, whoever, use the Tesla. I can't use it right now. I'm on tour. I'm on this bus. You want to go use it while I'm gone? Go for it. He knows what he thinks it's being used by someone that's not putting a body in the trunk. I don't know.
All right. I'm just going to say this as a Tesla owner. Everything to do with that Tesla is on my phone.
Yep.
Everything. So my Tesla tells me it's open, it's closed, somebody's next to it, whatever's happening with it. It's all, you open it, you close it, you lock it. Everything's done on your phone. So when you just got rid of the app and just erased everything about his Tesla. If not, he's going to be lit up with every time he opens that Tesla door. So I just can't go with the ignorance is bliss, Tony.
Unless he's I can't either, but doesn't want the alerts, though.
Yeah, what if he turned off alerts?
I turn off alerts all the time.
I'm just trying to look at it from all angles on this.
I agree. And I know I don't mean to be obtuse.
Yeah.
Because believe me, I'm not saying that I don't think others are involved. I'm very clear on this, that there's more than one person involved. And I think once they figure out who was involved, at least with concealment of the body, and they start pulling people in, we're going to know a lot, because people are going to start. He did it. He told me to do it. But we're waiting for that rock solid case. It's just going to take a while. It could take 2 years, just like Murphy.
And if people start leaking, we haven't seen any of that yet. But at some point, people start talking in something like this. You can only keep a secret for so long. And there are certainly human beings that are aware that something happened here. Exactly what is the question? Mm-hmm. All right, go get that Cornish hen, and I will get mine as well. It'll be great. It'll be the weirdest text back and forth, you and me sending pictures of decomposing Cornish hens in various states over the next 6 months. Not strange at all.
You know what'll be interesting, Tony, though, I have to say, is at what point would it not smell anymore?
Oh, boy.
I don't think there is a point where it doesn't smell anymore.
Years.
Point. There for sure is a point. Remember, I'm a farm girl. Grew up on a farm, doing everything with animals from the standpoint of killing them, slaughtering them, eating them, keeping them.
Yeah.
All of that. And there is a point where you have carcasses and they don't smell anymore.
But that'd be like sun-dried, you know? I mean, if you put the Cornish hen in a freezer and did it, the smell would go. But I think what we're doing, keeping it at like air temperature of like 60-ish or more degrees in a Tupperware, that shit's going to smell until they'll smell until we're dead. Like, that thing's never going to, it'll take some time.
What do you see on that, Tony? You know what? So July 4th is our D-Day, unless we get more information.
Yeah.
If we hear more information that know the timeline has changed and they have a picture of her in, you know, whatever, June, we need to adjust our timeline.
All right. Then we'll pop open the Cornish hen sooner. And at a dinner party with our favorite guests. Hey, everybody. pop and seal. There you go. All right, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. Thank you, as always, for coming on and giving us your insight into all this, and I'm excited about the hens. Until next time, for Jen, for Stacey and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.